professor at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's also head of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development in Houston, Texas, and an author. The doctor's latest book is Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The trade war between the United States and China intensified, both Washington and Beijing taking shots at each other. Friday, VOA's Steve Herman reports that President Trump is ordering the U.S. taxes increased on Chinese products valued in excess of $500 billion.
The U.S. president took action after China announced it is raising tariffs on $75 billion of U.S. goods and resuming 25% tariffs on American autos in retaliation against duty increases Trump had earlier proposed. Trump on Friday also said he is ordering American companies to immediately start looking for alternatives to China, but he did not explain under what authority he is making the order to American industry. The tit-for-tat actions by the two countries have unsettled financial markets. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Hong Kong is gearing up for more protests as some demonstrators plan to again target the city's airport over the weekend. Hong Kong police said Friday that the High Court extended an order restricting protest at the airport. Its airport authority also published a half-page notice in newspapers urging people to love Hong Kong and not block the airport. Protesters have called for an attempt Saturday to blockade routes to the airport, which could disrupt the complex if large numbers turn out. North Korea has conducted another missile launch, violating an apparent promise to U.S. President Donald Trump to refrain from such tests after the conclusion of U.S.-South Korean military exercises. Japan's government first reported the launch, calling it a ballistic missile. South Korea's military confirmed the news a little later, saying that North Korea fired two unknown projectiles from South Hamgyong province into the sea off its eastern coast. Earlier this month, Mr. Trump said in a tweet that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un promised to stop launching missiles and return to nuclear talks once the latest round of South Korean and U.S. military drills ended. This is VOA News. Under increasing international pressure to contain fires sweeping parts of the Amazon, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has authorized the use of military to battle the massive blazes. The fires in the environment have taken center stage as G7 leaders gather in France for a four-day summit. Reuters' Joe Davies.
The four-day summit gets underway here in Biarritz on Saturday. The big theme is supposed to be about improving inequality across the world, but as security is tightened ahead of world leaders arriving, instead the theme appears to be securing the future of the planet. The Amazon rainforest is burning at a rate never seen before. Hundreds of thousands of hectares have already been destroyed. It's prompted French President Emmanuel Macron to declare an international crisis, as he called on fellow G7 leaders to urgently discuss the matter. And Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has said Dublin will vote against a trade deal between the European Union and the South American trade bloc Mercosur unless Brazil takes action to protect the rainforest.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has another bout with cancer. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has details.
The Supreme Court says 86-year-old Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has completed radiation therapy for a tumor on her pancreas, and there's no evidence of the disease returning. Court says Ginsburg does not need any additional treatment, but will continue to have periodic blood tests and scans. She has had several bouts with cancer over the last 20 years. Last December, she had surgery for cancerous growths on her left lung. Tim McGuire, Washington.
The United States and Japan have reached the broad framework of a trade agreement, with Washington maintaining tariffs on Japanese autos, but Tokyo cutting tariffs on U.S. beef and pork. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and economy, the minister, the Japanese prime economy minister, reached a deal on Friday in Washington, and it will be announced at a meeting of President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Sunday on the sidelines of the Group of Seven summit in France, according to a newspaper. Billionaire David Koch, a major donor in conservative Republican politics, has died at the age of 79. His older brother, Charles, announced his death on Friday, saying, "It is with a heavy heart that I announce the passing of my brother David. Anyone who worked with David surely experienced his giant personality and passion for life." That's, again, according to the elder Koch brother in a statement. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, the VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Hello, and welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition, our focal point is India's recent move to change the status of Jammu and Kashmir. What is the underlying symbolism of Delhi declaring Muslim-majority Jammu and Kashmir to be what it terms part of the Union, no longer deemed semi-autonomous? After decades of Jammu and Kashmir's status left essentially unchanged, why did this happen now? And considering that India and Pakistan have had military clashes over the status of this northern mountainous region, what will happen now that Delhi has made such an aggressive move? Meanwhile, Jammu and Kashmir are effectively cut off from the rest of the world, with the internet, mobiles, and landline phones shut down for some time, and Indian troops are now heavily deployed in the region. Hello, I'm Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. With us to define and discuss the situation are two seasoned analysts of the subcontinent. From the Washington-based research organization, The Atlantic Council, South Asia Division Director Irfan Noureddin, and Foreign Policy Magazine Managing Editor Ravi Agrawal. FP Magazine has written extensively about India and Pakistan, especially regarding this move by Delhi. Well, for Encounter listeners who don't know the history of conflict over Jammu and Kashmir, I know that this is ancient news for people who study the region and know the history of it. But let's just do a quick recap of why the region was partitioned back when India and Pakistan became independent in 1947 and how those two countries fought over it multiple times. Mr. Noureddin, how do you describe this?
Pre-colonial or in colonial era India, the Hindus and Muslims have coexisted, though were often ruled by local princes who had autonomy over particular parts of it. And under British India, these local rulers essentially paid fealty to the crown, and as long as they towed the line, had some autonomy. Jammu and Kashmir was ruled by a Hindu king, even though it was a Muslim-majority province. And when it came to 1947, the history is sordid, the history is long, it's tragic, but the decision was made that Muslims of the subcontinent arguably needed their own country in the post-colonial era, and this is where Pakistan was born. For India, the crux of its national identity was that it would be secular, a home for both Hindus and Muslims, as well as Christians, Parsis, Sikhs, Jains, Buddhists, and other religions of the subcontinent. But the question was, how did individual princes or rulers of their provinces decide to which side to go? And the British said, you get to choose. And essentially what happened in Jammu and Kashmir is that the ruler of the province chose to accede to independent India as opposed to independent Pakistan. This was controversial from the Pakistani perspective because their argument was that Pakistan was a home for Muslims and a Muslim-majority state like Kashmir should have naturally, from their perspective, joined Pakistan. For India, as a secular country, the argument was no. These are fully Indian citizens and will be protected under the full rights of the Indian Constitution. And so what has happened over the last 70 years is that this moment of creation, this original sin, if you would, of the question of how and why Kashmir came to be part of India has been at the crux of the three wars, 70 years of skirmishes, a lot of bad blood between these two large countries.
What additional details would you like to add to that, Mr. Grawal?
Well, Irfan summed it up really well, but a few other additional details would be that as part of joining the Union of India, Kashmir had certain autonomies granted to it. And among those were two key articles in the Indian Constitution, Article 370 and 35A. They allowed the state of Kashmir to have certain autonomies, its own flag, for example, but also non-Kashmiris were not allowed to buy land within the state of Jammu and Kashmir. Those are the two key constitutional clauses that were removed on August 5th by Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister. And this is controversial because, on the one hand, Kashmiris have long been promised a referendum of sorts, a plebiscite, where they would get to choose what their future would be, whether they would be able to have Kashmiri independence or any of the other options on the table. That, of course, never came about. But India's stance is that its decision and the area over which it has made its decision is Indian-administered Kashmir. So this is a part of the Kashmir, Jammu and Kashmir, that they were already controlling, which is about 45% of the total mass of Kashmir, whereas Pakistan controls its part, about 35% of the total mass. And then finally, China controls a very small portion known as Aksai Chin.
It was only a few weeks ago that Imran Khan, the Pakistani Prime Minister, visited the White House. And at that time, President Trump offered to mediate the longstanding dispute between India and Pakistan. And it was shortly thereafter that Home Minister Amit Shah in Delhi announced that Jammu and Kashmir's special autonomous status or semi-autonomous status was being revoked, etc. Now, should I even try to connect dots between these two events?
I mean, it's quite well known now that the two are connected. There have been reports from senior officials in India who say that while Modi and Shah had always planned to take these moves because it was widely telegraphed, it was in their campaign manifesto in the last elections, which concluded in May, they may have brought forward these actions by weeks or months, in part because of Trump's offer to mediate in Kashmir. And just to back up a minute, the reason why Trump's offer is as controversial as it is because it has long been India's policy and a policy that it has lobbied for across the board globally, that the status of Kashmir is purely a bilateral issue for India and Pakistan to decide among themselves, and that there is no need for any international body to discuss this issue. Pakistan, on the other hand, has long sought to internationalize the issue of Kashmir. And so for Pakistan, getting Trump to say that, or having Trump say that with the Pakistani Prime Minister in the room, was a victory of sorts. For India, this was a failure of diplomacy and an embarrassment of sorts. So there is a strong connection between the two, at least in timing.
I think Ravi's point about the timing is critical, and maybe we can expand on that. What we have is a moment in which the Indian government suddenly hears the U.S. president talk about mediation, which had been something that no U.S. president prior to Trump had gone, because this was no-go territory for the Indian government. They simply would not allow for mediation. What's at the crux for mediation and the bilateral context over here is really the dispute over the line of control and whether or not Pakistan-occupied Kashmir could continue, whether, of course, from Pakistan's perspective, Indian-occupied Kashmir could continue. But the revocation of Article 370 and Article 35A, from India's perspective, is not even bilateral. It is a purely internal issue because it only affects that part which has always been administered by India and part of the Indian state. And so Trump's comment, misguided, arguably, probably without any vetting by his colleagues in the State Department, would be my guess. This is not U.S. policy. This was a comment made by a president given to making fairly impulsive comments, probably got Delhi saying, we want to do this anyway. Let's do it right now. We're going to nip this in the bud. And actually, from a purely timing perspective, it's quite brilliant. Imran had had a very successful visit to Washington, far more successful than I think most observers thought it would be. And this changed the news cycle automatically. All of a sudden, we weren't talking about Imran looking good in the White House, a positive meeting. We were talking about this big move by the Indian government. And in recent weeks, we had a big delegation of the U.S. State Department, including the Deputy Secretary, in Delhi. And so Delhi sort of had a master stroke, in my opinion, from a timing perspective. They changed the news cycle away from Khan, and then they get a senior American administration officials in Delhi on their turf, lots of conversations to say, hey, don't overreact, back off. We're not talking about mediation. And so I think purely from a timing perspective, Delhi wins this round.
Much has been written and said in recent weeks about how Delhi's action reflects the strength and the intensity of Indian, especially Hindu nationalism, as expressed by Prime Minister Modi and his BJP. I'd like to get both of your perspectives on this. So the balance in this mix is national identity, Hindu religiosity. Put it all in the blender and tell me what you get. What is the proportionate mix here between nationalism and religious fervor?
As I was saying, this move was widely telegraphed by Modi's government. So while it may have been a shock for the international news cycle, it really shouldn't be a surprise. This is something that the pro-Hindu Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, Modi's party, has long talked about. They have long aspired to bring Kashmir closer into the union. Of course, the merest hint of poking Pakistan in the eye plays very well for a broader Indian audience. But I should also point out that while this is part of a larger slate of Hindu nationalist moves by Modi and his government, there is broad popular support for this move in India. And that extends just beyond Modi's typical base. The people who are protesting Modi's move are mostly the elites in urban India and certain aspects of the media, which we may see more of sitting here in D.C., but this move is broadly popular and in that sense well calculated by Modi.
It is broadly popular, but for exactly, I would argue, the reasons, Jeffrey, that you mentioned, that this is majoritarianism at a very different level in Indian politics than we have seen before. So the popularity should not, I think, be mistaken for some sort of moral legitimacy. It is popular because over a long period of time, and definitely over the last 5 years, the Modi government has fanned the flames of Hindu majoritarianism. They have articulated, I think, a much sterner, stronger version of what a Hindu nationalist identity for India would look like. Even the phrase you used in your open to talk about bringing it in a closer part of the union suggests that Kashmir was not part of the union in some sense, that we are asking questions about really their commitment to the Indian Union, and this is going to force them fully in, which I think is a dog whistle to a part of that population that effectively saw the Muslim majority Kashmir as having divided loyalties, and it is only by forcing them in, by taking away the state government, by making it a union territory to be controlled by Delhi, that they're actually going to be forced into the union. So, you know, beyond sort of whether or not this particular constitutional move makes sense, the fact that there isn't widespread protest about multiple weeks of house arrests of mainstream legitimate politicians, mass arrests of journalists and other activists, and the complete cutoff of all communications to millions of your fellow citizens is, I think, tremendously revealing and troubling, because it suggests that these actions, if targeted against a minority, are not going to engender opposition by large proportions of the country as a whole. I think it's a scary time in that regard.
That topic, that particular thing that you just brought up, we're going to amplify that and get into it in much greater detail a little bit later in the program. But I wanted to bring this up right now. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi says Islamabad is going to take India's move on Jammu and Kashmir to the International Court of Justice. He claims Delhi has committed human rights violations against the people living in that region. Now, anyone can take a case to the International Court of Justice. Traction is another story. What do you think about this move? Is this just political mollification toward a base in Pakistan? Is this an actual actionable event? What do you think?
I think it's posturing. I mean, Pakistan has limited moves it can make. It already tried to amplify the issue at a special UN Security Council meeting a few days ago. That didn't quite work out well. In fact, at that meeting, the council members couldn't even agree for the lowest level of action, which is a statement to the press, because Russia, the US, and France strongly supported India in saying that this is purely a bilateral matter. Of course, the ICGA would take a different approach in that it's not driven by five great powers. But again, I mean, I think the legal basis for any action is quite limited here. So it is posturing. And short of, I think Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has said this as well in Parliament. He's like, what do you want me to do? Go to war?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's posturing in the sense that if you think that this is going to lead to revocation or the ICJ condemning the revocation of Article 370, Pakistan's not going to get any relief. They're not going to get any joy from the ICJ. But on the other hand, what the ICJ move allows them to do is begin to ask fairly embarrassing questions about the militarization of the region, about the detention of large numbers of the population, about the cutoff of communication lines, etc. And I think what that allows is Pakistan to shine a light that India probably doesn't want shone on the human rights concerns that lots of folks, right, including U.S. administration officials over years, have raised about how the troops act in Kashmir, the use of pellets to fire on protesting civilians, arguments about abuse of, especially sexual assault abuses by army officials against civilians in the society. So I think there are going to be questions raised that India doesn't really want raised. And that, I think, is the best case for Pakistan at the ICJ.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are South Asia Program Director Irfan Noordin at the Washington-based research organization The Atlantic Council and Mr. Ravi Agrawal, Managing Editor of the publication Foreign Policy, also based in Washington. Today's VOA Encounter program focuses on events in Jammu and Kashmir. What motivates India to break with decades and take stronger control of those northern mountainous regions, and what Pakistan may do in response? This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or you can connect with Encounter on Facebook. Here's a big shout out for one of our listeners, Facebook follower M. Safula from Punjab, Pakistan. If you want to hear your own name and country on this program, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or on Facebook. Give us a like and leave a comment. Now let's get back to the discussion on Jammu and Kashmir. What is life like right now for people in this region? Communications have been essentially cut off. The area has been heavily militarized. Security zones are everywhere. Tell me about life in Jammu and Kashmir this moment. What can you say?
Well, the truth is we know very little, because the communication blackout is not just for the citizens, but it's also been for the press and media. And so we know very little, but what we do know is that it's very hard right now to be an everyday citizen in Jammu and Kashmir. Mobility is tremendously limited. There is signs that the Indian government is beginning to ease restrictions. Landlines are coming back online. This is going to allow families to communicate with each other, be able to talk to each other. But the fact of the matter is that as acute as the problem has been over the last few weeks, life in Jammu and Kashmir has been anything but normal for many, many years. It is one of the most heavily militarized zones in the world. We have over 600,000 Indian troops in Kashmir. Curfews are commonplace. Internet blackouts are common. So the Jammu and Kashmir, the Kashmiris in the valley, are a hardy people. They have gone through things that, frankly, I could not imagine having lived through. This is just one more case of it. But now with the added, let's say, insult to injury of having the one article of faith about their particular status in the Indian Constitution and in the Indian Union taken away from them. And so I think the question is less about whether life is difficult. Life has been difficult for too many years. But whether or not life being difficult in addition to what many will portray as a betrayal of the Indian government adds to something that cannot be controlled.
And consider the irony of this in the world's largest democracy, the fact that the Kashmiri people were not consulted. Many of their leaders were locked away in the days leading up to this. Protests have not been allowed because of not only physical curfews and tens of thousands of troops being on the ground, but also the fact that the internet services have been shut down. And so people can't disseminate images. They can't communicate with each other. They can't even protest online, which, as you know, globally is increasingly how people do protest. So in several ways, the Kashmiri people have simply not been allowed to tell their story. And there's been an immense media clampdown and a propaganda war as well, because on the one hand, you've had some reports from international broadcasters like the BBC, for example, which has shown videos clearly displaying protests of thousands of people, with the government then opening fire on them with tear gas. And then the government actually responding to that video online and saying it's fabricated, which is government government propaganda in this case. And as Irfan was saying, it's important to point out many of these things are not new. Even though, for example, the internet has been shut down for more than 2 weeks at this point, that itself is something that Kashmiris have long lived under. For the past 3 years, for example, Kashmir as a state and India as a country, therefore, have had more internet shutdowns than the next top 9 countries in the world combined. So Syria and Iraq are the second and third countries ranked by the number of internet shutdowns. India is way ahead of all of those countries. So the state, for several years now, has made life very difficult for Kashmiris.
There has been, for several decades, an insurgency at low to moderate levels in Kashmir against Indian authorities. Now we have the creation of a tight security state in Jammu and Kashmir in the last few weeks. What about this insurgency? Does this suppress the insurgency? Does this put a lid on it? Or does this embolden the insurgents to take action now that they have India directly in their face at a much higher posture level?
One quick maybe pushback. The security state is not the last few weeks. The security states are the last couple of decades.
Thank you.
Right? And so the insurgency, I think, is worth also maybe disaggregating. There are militants that are being armed, trained, and empowered by the Pakistani military and security establishment to cross the border from Pakistan-occupied Kashmir into Jammu and Kashmir to create trouble, right? Attack army military targets, attack soft targets when those were available. But the securitization of the state has meant that the army has been the main target of this, which of course plays very poorly, as it would in any country, on the Indian media and in the Indian public. And I think it's also worth just maybe inserting and reminding our listeners that in March of this year, there was a pretty high profile attack by the Indian Air Force across the international border into Pakistan in retaliation for a pretty significant suicide attack against Indian troops by one of these Pakistani trained militants. The question really, though, is whether or not this insurgency continues to have domestic, local Indian support and sentimentality to it. And I would argue that this has not been the case for a long time, that the average Kashmiri wants peace and stability, is loyal to the Indian state. But there's something about this move that brings that into question, that suggests that it is only by bringing Kashmir under the central government's rule that you can stem militancy in the valley, which to my mind suggests that the government's interpretation is that the state leaders have not done enough, may even have been sympathetic to some of the militancy, which I think is a very dangerous accusation. Will the insurgents be empowered? I don't think anything's going to change in terms of ways and means. The question is whether this allows them to gain a little more sympathy among ordinary Kashmiris who otherwise would have had no truck with them, but now saying the Indian state has betrayed us. Maybe this is the answer. One hopes that isn't the case.
And just moving this forward a little bit, the clampdown doesn't help, because there's this notion that clampdowns keep the peace. But on the other hand, you could argue that it is because of clampdowns by the state that there is widespread resentment, that there is anger, that there is rage. And there's no outlet for any of those very valid feelings of being let down by the state. In the coming weeks and months, I think the larger question for New Delhi is what to do next, because Modi himself has promised that in taking the action that he took on August the 5th, that he would be able to grow the Kashmiri economy, he would be able to create jobs. He was exhorting Bollywood, for example, to go into Kashmir and make films. There's a big Indian trade body that plans to hold a summit encouraging people to invest in Kashmir. Now, you can only do any of these things when there is no security clampdown and when the internet works and when communications work. The challenge for the government will be moving to that phase and having the confidence to do that and accepting protests that will come with all of those moves. And that's the problem that we face right now.
Yeah. And do you think Delhi is even willing to put up with a little bit of this, to allow this to happen? Or in its current mood, do you think that any sort of outspokenness or any sort of standing up against this is going to be dealt with firmly? Just to set an example, just to make it clear to everybody, Delhi's in charge. Accept it, get over it.
Protests, they might be willing to tolerate, but the mood has changed. We are talking about an India right now in which a tweet that criticizes the government, if it's by a prominent enough person or activist, is labeled as anti-national. You have mainstream news channels calling by name for the arrest of some of these activists and asking why the government hasn't done more against this. So in some ways, the government doesn't have to take much of a stance. They could let a protest occur while still having an environment in India that characterizes any democratic dissent as anti-national, as treasonous, etc. But there's another dimension over here, and I'd love to hear Rabi's take on this as well. The other promise that the Prime Minister has made is that Jammu and Kashmir will continue to have their own assembly, even as a union territory. They will have free and fair elections. But I don't see how they get there anytime soon, given that the mainstream political leaders, the legitimate leaders of political parties in Kashmir, including the three former chief ministers, two of whom worked with the BJP, have been under house arrest indefinitely. How do you get from there to free and fair elections?
I don't quite understand how one gets there either. I mean, there are so many aspects of the last couple of weeks of politics in India that don't add up, and this is one of those things that we'll be watching very closely.
Mr. Agrawal, Mr. Noordin, this has been quite a discussion. Since India and Pakistan were divided and became independent from Britain in 1947, Jammu and Kashmir have been fought over repeatedly. Now we know that India has revoked their semi-autonomous status and made them into two federal areas under Delhi's direct control, and the message to the area's Muslims in many eyes could not be clearer. My guests have been